This is a kind of a busy session, so I would like to start now. As we all know, you had earlier on in the course in embryology a session on head and neck development, and that was really the first introduction. Today we are going to look a little bit more closely at some of the details of head and neck development. And the first thing that you will know, if you look in your manual, is that there are an awful lot of differences between what happens in the head and neck as opposed to what happens in the trunk. First, some basics. And some of the basics that we would like to discuss are timeline. For anyone that is going to work and in healthcare delivery, there is going to be a time when you need to know about the periods in which you are sensitive and have a chance to develop a congenital malformation. In the case of head and neck malformations, they are extremely frequent, and it is very likely that before you will leave this institution, you will have seen several patients with congenital malformations of the head and neck. And certainly in your professional lifetime, you will see a lot of them. This timeline is something that I am going to ask you to look at. Again, just to remind you, there is a period of development between 4 weeks and 12 weeks in which the head and neck is really beginning to take shape. And in this period, there is a time in which the pharyngeal arches are present. And that, of course, is typically an important period for the neck. Then the development goes on to the external face, and then the primary palate and the secondary palate form. This particular period of time, of course, is something where the severity of the potential congenital malformations decreases with time. Early on, when there is a lot of activity going on in this area, if something goes wrong, it goes wrong in a major way. Toward the end of the time, things will be relatively minor, but still of importance to the patient who ends up with them. Here is the basic statement that we would like you all to know. The external face is essentially formed from two major sources. The first source is the first pharyngeal arch, which we now call the mandibular process. And the second source is the area of tissues that surrounds the forebrain. The first arch, the mandibular process, will give rise to a further outgrowth that is going to be known as the maxillary process. This is something that I want you to remember. There is at this moment a little doubt about that. Some people working on bird development, avian birds, have found that the maxillary process may in fact develop separately. That is something that was very well proven by those investigators, but quite frankly, I don't think at this time we can translate this to the mammalian condition. So for now, let's just say that the maxillary process is an outgrowth of the mandibular process, therefore first arch related. The frontonasal process is the other area, and when you look at the same shading in the fully formed face, you can clearly see what parts of the face are formed from the first arch and what parts are formed from the tissues that are coming from the frontonasal process. This is the picture I really need to bring to your attention. This picture shows you the facial processes that are involved in the development of the external face. And you are already very much aware there's a lateral and a medial nasal process on both sides. There's a maxillary process and a mandibular process, which is, of course, coming from the mandibular arch. And I want you to particularly look at the relationship between those two processes. If you look at the relationships, what you notice is that between the lateral nasal and the medial nasal process here, there is a groove, a little very shallow groove. And the same thing is true here. There's a little shallow groove here. And then there is a groove here between the lateral nasal process and the maxillary process. There is even, you can make a claim, a groove between maxillary and mandibular, and there certainly is a groove here between the two mandibular processes. So when you're looking at all of these grooves, what you are seeing is the separation between the processes, but the separation is very minor, very minimal, in that it is a groove that needs to be eliminated. And so the thing that you have to know, the first thing is that in most of the area of the external face, what you are faced with is the process of elimination of the groove between two adjacent processes. If that works normally and if that works fine, then you have, in fact, normal development. If the groove does not get eliminated, you end up with a cleft in any of these areas where groove elimination is taking place. And so what you can draw here is a face, and you can say, okay, there was a groove here, and there was a groove here, and there was a groove here, and a groove here, and can just follow all of these and these. The ones that I have now marked, and I have left out in this particular view, two lines. These two lines here are not formed by merging. So they are involved with fusion. But all the other ones in which I have strengthened the lines with red are the areas where you had the groove, where groove had to be eliminated. And so if the groove does not get eliminated in the way it should, then you get a facial cleft. So now we come to the other mechanism. We had one mechanism which is merging, and now we have the other mechanism which is fusion. And the difference between merging and fusion is simply that in the case of fusion, you have two facial processes that come together, but they still are covered on the outside surface with epithelium. That is known as medial edge epithelium, as you know. And the medial edge epithelium is, in fact, involved in the gluing together of these two processes, and then it has to be removed for the fusion to be complete and successful. Now, these areas where fusion occurs are, in fact, the areas that are involved in the development of primary palate and of secondary palate. So primary and secondary palate have the process of fusion to bring the two processes together rather than merging. And you're seeing that here graphically shown, this is a horizontal view. Kind of difficult to say. It's an oblique view. There is a maxillary process coming here. Intermaxillary segment, which is really the combined medial nasal processes. And when these two processes come together, there is a fusion of the epithelium on the surface. And then here in the subsequent picture, you're seeing here the mesenchyme becomes continuous and the epithelium is removed. And the same thing is true for this. So this is primary palate. And here is the secondary palate. And in the secondary palate, again, what you find is two palatal processes, or shelves, coming together, approaching each other in the midline, and then when these two palatal shelves come together, they are literally fused together and the epithelium disappears. I am going to just show you this here in this image. And I would like you to just look at it again, because this is one of the areas where we really have to look closely. Here you see the epithelium is moving off. What you're seeing here now is the area where the two nasal processes, here's the medial nasal process on this side, the lateral nasal process on this side, and now these two are coming together. And they have fused. And now look next here at the mesenchyme. It becomes continuous. The epithelium is lost. And now here in the back, you have the area where the epithelium is broken down and you form an oronasal membrane. So let's do this once more. Always a good fun thing to see. Okay, epithelium comes off. Here's the fusion, mesenchymal merging, and now here the oronasal membrane being removed. I now having seen that, you can now look back and let's now look at this. Here it is. This is now an horizontal image. And the horizontal image shows you the maxillary process coming here, and this is the maxillary process on the other side. And what you're seeing here are the two medial nasal processes. Two medial nasal processes, which together form the maxillary segment. And this intermaxillary segment now becomes fused with the two maxillary processes here and here. And you see that here the fusion line is over here, and then the epithelium in that fusion line will disappear. This is the three-dimensional graphics of this same process. And what you're now seeing is if you just take the outline here, the epithelium that you're seeing here, and you're just following that and you make a 3D reconstruction, what you're seeing here now is that nasal pit that is formed when various processes come together and surrounding the area of the olfactory epithelium. This is the region where the epithelium is fused together. And then gradually, because of differential growth, you find that this epithelium is gradually pulled apart, and as it is pulled apart, the mesenchyme is becoming continuous. The process is illustrated here as pulling apart. The epithelium, in fact, is in part pulled apart, but it's also in part changing into another kind of tissue. We'll come back to that in a moment. Here now is the full 3D reconstruction. You see this is again the nasal pit. And the nasal pit, just to review that, is between the medial nasal process and the lateral nasal process. And anterior to that, you have the maxillary process, which fuses together with the medial nasal, not shown here. They didn't want to make it too complicated. And now what you're seeing here, this area of epithelium, is the nasal fin. And the nasal fin is that vertical plate of fused epithelium, which then gets mostly removed, and the mesenchyme becomes continuous, but only in this area right here do you have the oronasal membrane. So you're seeing here in 3D just the epithelium of these various processes, the nasal pit and the oronasal membrane that eventually becomes the opening that is known as the primitive choana. Here a slightly more ancient picture, but it's really quite nice. What you're seeing here now is again the nasal pit. Here is the oronasal membrane that is going to be broken down, and then you will have a pathway, an opening that permits communication between the nasal pit and the oral cavity. Here then is what you actually see. The oronasal membrane is really very small. The oronasal membrane is just a couple of layers of epithelium. These are just ectodermal layers. The ectoderm from the nasal side and the ectoderm from the oral side. And in a very brief period of time, roughly around 6 weeks of development, that particular oronasal membrane begins to break down. We are going to unhook ourselves here.
Okay. Thank you. Bye, Marvin.
And this breakdown of the oronasal epithelium now produces an opening, and this opening is visible right here. So to show you how that opening really is, where it is located, what you're seeing here now is from below, you are here looking at the lateral nasal process and the medial nasal process here, and this is the maxillary. And what you're seeing here now is this is the little opening that is the site where the oronasal membrane was located, and you now find that if you put a probe in the nasal cavity, it would come through this primitive choana and give access to the oral cavity, which is visible here. So this is the area of the oral cavity. So far, is this clear? Okay, we now entre nous among ourselves, so no more lights, no more cameras. Okay. And is it clear or not? Seriously, yeah.
Start from the beginning.
Hey, not so fast.
You were starstruck.
Yeah. Okay. All right then. So essentially what we have here is a situation where the primary or primitive palate is in fact formed by these different components. Let's just outline them here. You have two maxillary processes, maxillary, medial nasal. Okay? That forms that intermaxillary, just two medial nasal processes form the globular process or the intermaxillary segment. Those are the two terms that you can use for this particular combined area. I also want you to see here this little bulge here and this little bulge here, which is kind of what is going to be part of the primary palate also. That is, it's really part of the medial nasal process, but it's kind of sticking out in the direction of the palate itself. So from the medial nasal process, there's this little extra bulge that is going to be part of the primary palate. But this is it. So primary palate then is essentially the structure, the horseshoe-shaped structure that separates the nasal cavities from the oral cavity. And now what you're having here is the beginnings of the palatal processes, which are forming on the oral surface of the maxillary processes. This particular image here is a rather nice one. It's a recent publication, and it shows you very beautifully here the area of the maxillary process, the beginning of the palatal processes over here. These were the two little bulges that I showed you before. These are the primitive choanae right here and here. And you now get the outgrowth of the palatal processes, as you can see here. These are the actual images below. And what you're seeing here is that gradually, when the palatal processes move to a horizontal position, they start to fuse with the primary palate in front of them, and then gradually they're going to fuse with each other. Now, there are, in fact, a whole series of things going on. And when you are going to look at patients that have palatal clefts, what you will very frequently hear is that this is the result of a multifactorial series of problems. And essentially what you're really hearing is that the development of the palate is subject to a large number of factors. Many factors feature in the development of primary and secondary palates. And if there is a cleft, it can be as a result of very many different factors in combination or separate, and it's very hard frequently to tell which one is really responsible for a cleft. What you're seeing here is the development of the secondary palates in a sagittal view, and what you're basically seeing in this view here is the beginning of this nasal pit. The medial nasal swelling is shown here in section, and this here is the oronasal membrane right here. And then after 6 weeks of development, that oronasal membrane is broken down, and you now have a primitive choana. And as the entire complex, the oronasal complex, is growing in an anteroposterior direction, the palatal processes begin to form, and at a certain point they come together, they lift up to a horizontal position, and now you have a secondary palate that further separates the enlarged oral cavity and enlarged nasal cavity. The same view is shown here in horizontal, in a coronal view, and what you're seeing here now is the palatal process in a vertical position, more or less, then the very quick movement up to a horizontal, and then finally, as they grow together, there is fusion. Okay? So palatal processes that give rise to the secondary palates start out vertically, move to a horizontal position, and then undergo fusion. This process takes place roughly between 7 and 8 weeks. Okay? So this is a critical period. Between 7 and 8 weeks, you have the formation of the secondary palate. Now let's understand what is involved in the development of the secondary palate, because that gives you a very good handle on all of the various things that must happen for the process to be successful. Let's begin with the intrinsic factors and look at that first. Intrinsic factors for development of secondary palates are mesenchymal cell proliferation. You need to increase the number of cells in the secondary palates to allow the palatal processes to grow. And so proliferation of mesenchymal cells is quite necessary, but it occurs for a while, but then it ceases a few hours before the palatal process become horizontal. Nevertheless, this is important. Secondly, the mesenchymal cells need to produce extracellular matrix because that also, in addition to the increase in the number of cells, increases the volume of the palatal processes. And then finally, and a very important key, is the hydration of the extracellular matrix. You can have cells, you can have extracellular matrix, but if the extracellular matrix does not become hydrated, the palatal processes, in fact, do not become significantly larger, and the turgor does not develop. Because the actual increase in volume is really due to the hydration of the extracellular matrix. If you look at the palatal process in an earlier stage, what you find is that the cells seem to be very close together. At a later stage, just before the horizontalization of the process, you have a situation that looks like this. So the density of the cells actually is becoming reduced, and the extracellular matrix in between is becoming increased in size. Now the palatal processes are going to become horizontal. This is an image that is taken from human material. This is seen from below. You're seeing here the palatal process. They are in a vertical position at this point. The tongue has actually been taken out for the preparation of this specimen, but the tongue was actually sitting inside here and slightly above these palatal processes. But once the tongue gets out of the way, and that's critical for the next stage, the palatal processes now become horizontal really quickly, and that is a movement around, if you wish, a hinge axis. The palatal processes literally start out like this, and then they move up like this. That's a rapid movement that occurs. And again, I would like you to see this because it really it gives you a very good sense of the sequence of events. I show you this here. Now, I want you to see this. We very frequently get a specimen where on one side the palatal process is already horizontal, on the other side the palatal process is still vertical. It's still being held in place. So this kind of slightly asymmetric behavior for a very limited amount of time is very normal. We do it again. Here it goes. Whee! That's fine. Okay. And then here is the area where fusion will occur. Just one more time, just for fun. Okay, look at it. Is that great or is that great? Yeah. Okay. All right, go crazy. So, let's look what produces the horizontalization of the palatal processes. Turgor in the palatal process. In order for these cells, or for these processes, to be able to move from a vertical position to a horizontal position, they have to have a certain rigidity, which is produced by the turgor. So the rigidity of the palatal processes allows them to move in a hinge-like fashion from vertical to horizontal. If they were just floppy and just soft and not really very rigid, that would not occur. Movements of the tongue. Please now remember, At 7 weeks and at 8 weeks, the embryo is swallowing. The sublingual musculature is active. It is contracting. It is among the first muscles to actually start contracting. It is right in this area. It's very far advanced compared to the rest of the body. And you have swallowing motions taking place, and the tongue moves out of the way. And that's good, because by the tongue moving out of the way, the palatal process has have a place to move to. Importantly also, the lower jaw grows downward and forward in this time. And so it allows further vertical space for the secondary palate. And then there is a final thing, the straightening of the cranial base. Now that seems like a little far-fetched, but actually the mechanics of the palatal development really require that this occurs. Let's show that to you now. Here it is. What makes the cranial base straighten? Look at this here. This is a young specimen, and then at a slightly later stage it looks like this, and by the time the palatal processes have moved in a horizontal position, that is number 4, you see that the angle between this part of the cranial base and the anterior part of the cranial base, here and here, gradually that angle has increased. Okay? Why is that? Because the curvature of the embryo, when the embryo is very small, the curvature is extremely tight. There is a very high curvature that is present. As the embryo gets larger, the curvature comes on a larger circumference, and thereby it is less curved in the older specimens than it is in the previous one. You can show this to yourself. I'm going to suggest that you take a little piece of tubing, little tube, and you take a very sharp knife, and you're going to make a cut that is not extending all the way to the ends of that tubing. And I have it here, and I can show it to you anytime you'd like, but I think you, especially people that are way in the front and in the back there, are going to have a hard time doing it. This is my little tube. And you see that little dark line there, that is the cut that I've made. And for those of you that sit in front, if you see I have now kind of made the tube curved, you can see there is these little edges of the cut are sticking down. And now when I let the tube relax, the edges of the cut come back. And this is really a very good demonstration of palatal processes going from a vertical position here, in the curved position of the tube, to a more horizontal position in the straight condition of the tube. If you want to try it out and see me with it, that is fine. But this is really a very good mechanical demonstration of the curvature of the cranial base does for the conditions of palatal process horizontalization. The end point is here. The end point is shown. This is about 8 weeks of age, human embryo, and what you're seeing here now is the palatal process, fusion line in the middle, epithelium, the medial edge epithelium, is still in place. The structure above, which is formed by the two medial nasal processes, is still separate, but it too will fuse with the two palatal shelves. So now the next thing is happening. The next part of the successful story of secondary palate formation is the removal of the medial edge epithelium. And in fact, the medial edge epithelium has many functions in this particular story. First of all, in order for the fusion to be able to take place, the superficial cells of the medial edge epithelium have to be removed. You need cells that are not fully differentiated, that are sitting on the outside. You need the cells further, deeper below, that are actually capable of responding to their counterparts of the other palatal process. And what you're getting is a situation where the epithelial cells are sitting here, and as they approach each other, they start to throw out filopodia, and the filopodia become intertwined, and as they become intertwined, they actually start to pull those two epithelial layers together, and that's the beginning of fusion. Back to the felt tip. So the second thing is, so first of all, you need to remove the outermost layers of the medial edge epithelium. Then we have to have glycoprotein membrane coating on those cells that are having those filopodia, so that adhesion can occur between the two medial edge epithelial layers. And finally, and that's of course the last stage, but very important, you have to remove the medial edge epithelium. And that is something that is occurring in a variety of ways. It used to be thought that all you had to do was to for the cells to die, and they had to undergo phagocytosis, and that was it. But in fact, there are several possibilities for the cells of the medial edge epithelium. One is passive stretch and incorporation in the nearby surface epithelia. Do we know how much of that occurs? Not really. Can we quantify it? Really not. But does it occur? Probably yes. Then secondly, apoptosis and phagocytosis. Some cells undoubtedly undergo cell death and are removed by phagocytes. And then there is the newest wrinkle, and that is epithelio-mesenchymal transformation. And we now think that that is in fact a very important mechanism. Let's look at each one of them. First, this passive stretch. We have only circumstantial evidence for it, but if you look at this epithelial wall, the fused medial edge epithelium, and you take that epithelial wall and you move it around and for about 90 degrees, and now look at it from the side in this direction. If you do that, what you're seeing is the following. The dark is the epithelium, and the areas that are light are areas where the mesenchyme has become continuous. And you notice that on the nasal side, here would be the nasal side, as opposed to the oral side, on the nasal side there are lots and lots of openings that have developed in that epithelial wall. On the oral surface, not so many. And the first suggestion is that there seems to be a disproportionate pull on the nasal side that produces this stretch-induced disappearance of epithelium, where the epithelium just kind of moves up into the nasal surface epithelium. So that is one possibility. As I said, we don't really have very good and adequate numbers. We have better data for this. The possibility of apoptosis, as demonstrated by the Tunnel reaction, where what you find is where you find that in the areas where there is DNA breakdown, a fluorescent tag can be attached, and you can actually show that apoptosis is taking place in the areas where you have this yellow fluorescence. And so in these areas we can say yes, epithelial cells are undergoing apoptosis, and if they are undergoing apoptosis, the remnants of the cells are being removed by phagocytosis. So that is another thing. And here in this picture here you see actually the garbage is being put out of the door, but that is another story. Okay. Now there are, for the third possibility, epithelio-mesenchymal transformation, there are actually very, very nice and good pieces of research being done. The research being done is this individual here, who is working with a very senior colleague of mine, Dr. Elizabeth Hay, at Harvard Medical School. And these two have been working very hard and seriously on the whole process of epithelial mesenchymal transformation, or EMT. Now, EMT is something that is very important in embryogenesis. It occurs all the time. Just think about neurocrest cells that start out as epithelial cells and then become mesenchymal cells. It happens, epithelial mesenchymal transformation, especially in the head. It's also important for tumors. Metastases of tumors require frequently that epithelium becomes transformed into mesenchyme. So the process of epithelial mesenchymal transformation is a process that occurs in many different areas. Now, if you're looking at these epithelial structures, this is the epithelial wall immediately after fusion, and then you see there's little openings beginning to develop. There are still some epithelial remnants here, but there are also areas where the mesenchyme becomes continuous, and then here there's still epithelial remnants here and here, and finally there are no epithelial remnants left, and the mesenchyme really is continuous. Now, when you look more closely at these epithelial remnants, you can actually see something very fascinating. In this area right here, which is shown at higher power over here and at really higher power in the picture on the right, what you're seeing here is that there is, in fact, a basal lamina, but there are little openings in there. You see filopodia. These epithelial cells are about to escape from the basal lamina and go into the mesenchymal domain. Now, you can say, oh, that's very suggestive, but do you really have data? And so the work that these individuals did was wonderful. What they are actually doing, they take palatal shells from mouse embryos, cut them out, put them in tissue culture, have these palatal shells actually fuse, and then what they're doing at given intervals, they cut these tissues, and they then very selectively pick out epithelial cells from the epithelial seam and collect them individually, and then do microarray gene analysis. And so that is In fact, the way that they are studying this at this point. And what they are able to show is if you are doing a very careful stage study of the epithelial cells, you see a gradual change where the epithelial markers gradually become repressed and where you're beginning to get mesenchymal markers and also markers that indicate that there is matrix degradation that is going and that begin to show. And so within these epithelial cells, which are very carefully collected and are shown, you know, it cannot be really much more precise. You can actually see gradually this kind of change taking place. And without going into these individual components, they will be posted. If you are interested in this particular topic, there is some very good material in the literature now available. The key point is that you are gradually seeing a loss of epithelial markers and an increase of mesenchymal markers. And that is, I think, as good a bit of evidence for epithelial mesenchymal transformation as any that you can get. Once the palate is fully formed and completed, it begins to look like this. You see still a little bit of a line here, but gradually it disappears. And then what occurs in the final weeks, between 8 and 12 weeks, you see an extension of the soft palate and gradually the formation of a uvula. The uvula still has a little cleft here, but then gradually by merging, that uvula will become continuous. And, of course, again, once you identify the sites where fusion occurs in the palate, both in the primary and in the secondary palate, you can then, of course, say anytime there is no success in the process, you have a cleft. And so you can have a unilateral cleft only in the lip, a unilateral cleft in the lip and the primary palate. So that's a complete cleft. You can have it bilaterally complete. You can have an isolated secondary palate cleft, or you can have a cleft that is both primary and secondary palate. So any of the combinations are in fact possible. Now, there are two areas that I wanted to speak with you more in detail about, and that is the Hawkes code that has significant influence on the development of the skeletal derivatives of the pharyngeal arches, and I want to also discuss with you some of the blood vessel story. As you know, and you are aware, the various pharyngeal arches have very specific derivatives, both skeletal, muscle, nerve, and vascular derivatives. And that is, in a significant way, under the direction of homeotic genes. And I would like to just remind you of an easy example. Homeotic genes can be involved, for example, in the segmentation of the trunk. Just to give you an example of that, if you look at the vertebral column, you will be aware that the vertebral column represents a series of segments. And the vertebral column, nevertheless, while every vertebra is recognizably a vertebra, there is a difference in the morphology of the vertebrae in the neck as opposed to the thoracic vertebrae and the lumbar vertebrae. So while each vertebra is a vertebra, there are slight segmental differences. And the same thing is true for the area of the pharyngeal arches. You have pharyngeal arches, they are segments. There are certain predictable presences of skeleton, blood vessels, muscles, nerves. But nevertheless, there are also the differences in the individual pharyngeal arches that make them unique in a way. And the reason why that can be done is because there is, in fact, a Hawkes code, homeotic genes, and they are present in a nested pattern. So there is a nested pattern of homeotic genes, and in this particular image I have only indicated two, the Hawkes 2 and the Hawkes 3. The darker one is the Hawkes 3, the lighter one is the Hawkes 2, and what you find is, and you can actually go further but we decided not to, what you find is that the Hawkes 2 has a significant influence on the second pharyngeal arch. The Hawkes 3 affects the third pharyngeal arch. It's very conveniently labeled. The first arch is actually in a Hawkes code default state. In other words, no Hawkes code is working on the first arch. And there's an interesting thing that comes along with that. So let's understand it. What you're seeing here is two conditions. This is a agnatin, a jawless fish. As you know, one example of that is a still living example is the lamprey. And this one is a gnatostome, which is a fish with the jaws. So the difference is between jawless and jawed fishes. And, of course, it continues on into our situation as well, into the mammalian condition. And one of the proposals that has been made is that the reason why the first arch was able to form actually an upper and a lower jaw was because it was not constrained by a Hawkes code. And because of that, when situations changed in the environment, the developing fish could in fact adjust to that by forming a different set of skeletal elements that actually had an upper and a lower jaw. In the agnatan fishes, there is no upper and lower jaw. There is just one of these arches here, but nothing more. And so what you have is a shift in the oral patterning. What you do have is another set of genes, the DLX code, that specifically affects the first arch components. But nevertheless, what you see here is that there is a Hox code that is affecting it. And there are good experimental conditions that have taught us a lot about the effect of Hox code. There's actually a Hox A2 and a Hox B2, but it is the Hox A2 that is considered to be the more important one. And what we find is that the Hox A2 is in fact very important for the morphology of the skeletal structures of the second pharyngeal arch. Interesting question. It's actually expressed by these rhombomeres, which includes rhombomeres that have neurocrest for the first arch. The reason why the neurocrest is nevertheless not expressing in the first arch the Hox A2 is that probably the gene was repressed by the fibroblast growth factor 8. So that then led to the Hox code default state. So the cells had it, but they lost it. Now, if you were to knock out the Hox A2 gene, what you find is that the cartridges in the second arch are showing major defects, and in fact, they seem to do behave like the cartridges in the first arch. And so that is something that is showing you that the first arch cartridges really are in a default situation. If you put the Hox A2 gene and express it in cells of the first arch, on the other hand, what you're getting is second arch type cartilages in the first arch. So the absence of Hox A2 leads to defects of the second arch cartilages, and if you express Hox A2 in the first arch, you get second arch cartilages. So that's, those two sets of experiments are pretty good. So let's can also tell you about the third Hox A3. Let me just briefly tell you about that. That does not seem to have an effect on the skeleton, but more on the blood vessels. So, again, it is in both cases, the Hox A2 and the Hox A3 have effects on the later development of the segments, but they then confer unique identities of these segments. Now, the final part of this story is the orofacial vascular supply, because it undergoes a very, very interesting series of changes. As you know, in the first stages, in the third and fourth week, the vascular supply in this region is by way of the pharyngeal arch cartilage, arteries, pharyngeal arch artery 1 and 2. And you also know that shortly after these arteries appear, they undergo involution. So they do not stay. And that is what is indicated by the stippled nature of these arches. So what happens to the tissues in that region? I mean, they are not going to be all of a sudden without blood vessels. And what is going to happen if you recognize this particular thing? This is a dorsal aorta. This is on the dorsal side. And this is the ventral aorta. These are strictly embryonic vessels, but very important. During the fifth week, what you find is that the orofacial tissues no longer get the supply from the pharyngeal arch arteries, but now they get it from the ventral aorta. So that is very nice. For a little while that works. And you also find the development of a new artery. And we're going to spend a little moment on that, looking at that. So that happens during the fifth week. Something new happens. And that is that if you look closely, you're seeing now here the aortic arches, the blood vessels. You see here this number 3, number 4, number 6, 5 also shown just briefly. But you notice that number 1 and 2 have just become this little capillary net, and they are pretty much gone. Now, look in this particular area here. What you see here is from the stump of the second arch, you see a little capillary outgrowth. And that is the beginning of the stapedial artery. And the stapedial artery, which begins to form in the fifth week, has a significant role in the sixth and seventh week of development. Here it is. What you're seeing here, this is the otic capsule. And here is the condensation of the future stapes. This is the facial nerve. Now, this, which says IC, is in fact the dorsal aorta. Dorsal aorta. And from that dorsal aorta, from that hyoid stump, you now see a little blood vessel growing out. That is the beginning of the stapedial artery. And after a while, and that is not too long after that, this is still in the fifth week, you find that that stapedial artery now has grown through that condensation, literally traversing it, and growing forward. And this here, just at the end of the fifth week, what you're getting now is the dorsal aorta, which is also becoming in the future the internal carotid artery, the dorsal aorta, and from the dorsal aorta, from the hyoid stump, that second arch artery, you now find the stapedial artery going forward. And what you're seeing here, notice that the stapedial artery runs through a hole of that cartilage. It's going to become the stapedial cartilage. And if you ever wondered why the stapes had a hole in the center, that's because of it. They had a blood vessel going through there, and the stapes formed around the blood vessel. So that is kind of neat. All right. So, during the sixth and seventh week then, you had now a newly formed stapedial artery, and this is the stapedial artery right here. And the stapedial artery now supplies the area of the blood vessels of the face. Okay? So, stapedial artery from this second stump supplies the blood vessels of the face. So, let's now go over what you had. This was the first arch artery which disappeared and some of the vessels that it supplied. Here is the second arch artery that disappears, and then from that stump you have the stapedial artery which grew forward and now connected up with the blood vessels of the face and supplies them. So during this 2 week period, 6 and 7 weeks, the stapedial artery supplies the blood vessels of the face. So first the first arch artery, then the ventral aorta, and now the stapedial artery. The final change is made when from the ventral aorta a new vessel grows out, and that becomes the external carotid artery. So the ventral aorta is not the external carotid, but it begins to give rise to the external carotid artery. And so once that happens, once that external carotid artery now grows out, it now connects up with the blood vessels of the facial region, and now it becomes the major supply. So during the 8 week, the definitive supply, after these three other types of supplies that you had before, now you form the external carotid, and it now forms the definitive supply of these blood vessels of the facial region. At this point, the stapedial artery is no longer needed and disappears. Okay? It is a very interesting series of changes. Now, why is it important? Well, there are two reasons why you should know about it. First of all, the stapedial artery does not always disappear. And so there are patients that will come around, and they don't even know that there's something very wrong with them, but they will also always tell you about this rushing sound that they have in their ear. A rushing sound in their ear is the stapedial artery running, yeah. No, this is not like tinnitus, no. This is a real rush. This is a constant flow of blood right through the middle ear.
I've heard helicopters
No, I don't think that's the same thing though. Yeah. Uh-huh.
If they're coming in, you know, however many X years old they are, would they even notice anymore?
No, they don't know. They don't notice it. They will just tell you that they hear it all the time, but they think it's normal that you hear it too. Okay? It's just, it comes out usually as a normal description, and I don't suggest that people should go in and try to make a change at that point. Now, the second thing is, and this is where it can have a major effect. If you have a series of blood vessels that continuously has to change the plumbing, it first loses its plumbing from the first artery, then you get it from the ventral aorta, and then you get the stapedial artery that takes over from the ventral aorta, and then you get the external carotid artery that takes over from the stapedial artery. That's a lot of connecting and disconnecting, and sometimes it doesn't work out well. And when it doesn't work out well, you may have an area where there is some blood that literally just begins to hemorrhage. You get blood vessels that are hemorrhaging, their blood is in the way, and when that happens, you may in fact interfere with the normal development of the face. And there are conditions where you have usually on one side something that may have happened with the blood supply, and the individual may have a significant reduction in the growth of that side of the face. So that is the story of the stapedial artery and how it affects you. Going the wrong way. And that is it. Let's take a 5-minute break, and then we'll have the introduction to the laboratory.